It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Could you forgive the one person who hurt you most?
I'd done my best to outrun my past. I'd filled my schedule around the clock to never have to dwell on what had happened to me.
Journalist Thordis Elva. And a word of warning, this story deals with sexual violence.
One day, I just had a fight with a loved one and I stormed out of the door in tears and I drove to a cafe. And I sat down and I pulled out a notebook. I wanted to doodle in it to calm my nerves. And to my surprise, out of the pen streamed this letter that broke this silence. And it was a detailed account of what had happened to me, what Tom was responsible for doing to me. And I expected a lot of outcomes. The only thing that I didn't expect was the reply that I then got.
I distinctly remember being on night shift at a drug rehabilitation service. There was a certain chill when seeing Thordis's name in my inbox. It was a chronological detailing of that night and what Thordis had experienced and what I'd subjected her to. The first effect of that email was to shatter a definition I had in my mind of that night of being sex. I had not identified what I did as rape. It was a horror. So my response was to reply and say, "Where to from here?"
Tom Stranger and Thordis Elva met when they were teenagers. They fell in love, became boyfriend and girlfriend, and then one night, they went home after a party, and he raped her. And afterwards, they didn't talk about it. Tom moved to Australia. Thordis lives in Iceland. They were pretty much out of touch for a decade until Thordis wrote that letter. And they struck up a correspondence. Over the course of several years, they exchanged hundreds of emails. Why?
This is something that's commonly shared by other survivors of sexual violence. We're all haunted by the question of why. Why did you do this to me? That's one of the questions that I posed to Tom, and I also wanted to make him aware of the consequences of his actions on my life. Because it was really painful to face the fact that the first time I gave my heart away, it resulted in abuse. But all of this was done in an attempt to heal.
Tom, what kept you invested in staying in touch with Thordis through these years of emails? Because, you know, I imagine this must have been complicated. It must have been really painful talking with a woman you'd assaulted years ago. You could have stopped replying. You could have just disappeared and avoided these email conversations. Why did you keep going?
Yeah. The first process was for me to comprehend my actions as rape and to understand that it was entirely not consenting, that I had not asked for consent. And it was a beginning of an analysis of my actions that night. And as clearly as I can state it, in terms of the why, because it's also been important for myself to know the why of that night and why I did what I did. And there was a sense of deservingness, a sense that when a boy goes out partying with his girlfriend, he's entitled to sex. And I took that attitude to a very dark place.
So this correspondence alone was extraordinary. But 8 years after it started, Thordis, you proposed meeting in person with the intent of reaching forgiveness. What did that mean to you, forgiveness?
I did not want my life to be dictated by the violence that I endured. I am more than what happened to me. So I realized that after 8 years of writing, that was a fantastic mode to exchange thoughts and questions that had haunted me. But at the end of the day, it is a silent format. And there's something really empowering about giving voice to your experiences, about speaking your truth. So I suggested that we would meet in the middle because we lived on opposite ends of the planet, with Australia and Iceland being as far away as it can be. So I suggested we'd meet in the middle to literally face our past once and for all, with the hope that something constructive could be built out of a deep pain, that something good could ultimately come out of it, something that could be of use, not just to me personally, but hopefully be a contribution to something bigger.
Tom, why did you agree to meet, and what did forgiveness mean to you?
Yeah, as Thordis has discussed, the notion of forgiveness was not a traditional and almost romanticized notion of forgiveness. It was not set as a destination to find during the week in Cape Town. It was very much about understanding the past. But this also had value for me in that I knew that it was important to hear face to face what that night had meant for Thordis. And it would also give me an opportunity to air things that I'd held on to as well.
Mm-hmm. So you both traveled across the world to this in-between place, Cape Town, South Africa. You met, I can't imagine what it was like seeing each other for the first time. But then you spent a week having these conversations with each other. What was the first one? What did you talk about?
Well, you're right. It was a very fraught moment seeing Tom again for me. The first conversation was actually quite mundane. We started by going back into the past and into our childhoods. I wanted to know where the boy that decided to do what Tom did to me that night when I was 16, I wanted to know where he came from. I wanted to know what shaped his ideas. I wanted to know what his life had been like up until that point. And I also wanted to understand what it had been like to be him after that, to live with what he did, because I certainly knew what my story had been.
So it sounds like part of what needed to happen for you, for both of you, is seeing yourself outside of the box of victimhood and seeing Tom outside of the box of perpetrator. Not to say that he didn't rape you, but it sounds like somehow you needed to see him as a whole, complete, bigger person.
Well, the thing is, I think that part of the problem when it comes to sexual violence is this one-dimensional, stereotypical view that we often have of those who perpetrate it. I like to call it the monster myth. When I was 16 and this happened to me, I thought that perpetrators were armed lunatics that lurked, you know, in bushes and jumped at you. They certainly weren't someone that you cared for or trusted, and they certainly weren't your boyfriend. So I think that stereotypical notion actually held me back from realizing what had happened to me. So I had this senseless pain, but I couldn't put it into perspective until later when I knew more about sexual violence.
Tom, you guys spent that week in Cape Town together, having a lot of conversations, walking around, seeing things. What was the most difficult conversation you had?
Without a doubt, it was the conversation that we had on the third day we were there. We reached that night, December 17th, 1996, and walked through the events of that night.
What surprised you? Because you guys had emailed and you'd thought about this for years. What did you learn that you didn't know?
Yeah, I think it was about the anger. I think it was about the power of sitting there and seeing it in person, seeing essentially in the room what this had meant for her.
There was a storm in Cape Town that day, so the weather was quite dramatic. Scaffolding was blown off buildings, trees were uprooted, and the glass was actually quivering, like in the window pane, while we were we're having this conversation. So there was this quite dramatic backdrop, which weirdly mirrored this difficult topic.
This was the culmination of a conversation that had lasted years. So yes, there was a pensiveness and a fear, but also a sense that this was the one occasion to be really raw and just revealing and to not soften or to hold anything back and to just hear Thurtis, and for me to also say out loud that word that I'd struggled with for a long time, and to acknowledge that it was rape and to take it on and to voice that it was mine, that Thurtis didn't do anything wrong, and that it was my act and due to my choices. Thurtis, she said, "What did you do to me?" essentially. And I repeated the words, "I raped you."
This sounds incredibly painful for both of you for very different reasons. I'm just trying to, like, how do you even say goodbye after that? What did you do?
It was late, and I felt a bit vulnerable being alone in a strange city after dark. So Tom accompanied me to a nearby restaurant.
You didn't eat dinner together, did you?
We did.
That night?
Yes.
And I understand in isolation, Anne, that might sound incredibly strange. As Thurtis said, there was a mundaneness. It was a certain emptiness after having that conversation. It was getting some food. It was talking about something else to a degree.
Mm. You know, one of the things I wonder is emotions don't always do what we want them to. You know, just mm-hmm. because you want to forgive, just because you want to let go of the anger doesn't mean that you can. So what did you have to do in order to genuinely forgive?
For me, it was very infused with the transference of responsibility. The whole process for me was very much handing that over to Tom and the wholehearted way in which he received it. That had a lasting effect on me. And I must say that I left Cape Town feeling lighter than I did before. There's something really powerful about having the deepest pain of your life acknowledged, spoken out loud, and listened to. And I'm not saying that survivors are dependent on their perpetrators for that, in that purpose. We can all be that person. Mm-hmm. We can all be the person that acknowledges another human being's hurt and says, "I believe you." I read somewhere that you should try and be the person that you needed when you were younger. And back when I was a teenager, I would have needed to know this, that the shame wasn't mine, that there's hope after an event like this, that you can even find happiness and your sense of self and your voice and your power. So that, I guess, is my answer.
Thurtis Elva and Tom Stranger. For more about them, check out their book South of Forgiveness, a true story of rape and responsibility. And Tom wanted us to mention that he's donating his share of the book's profits to a women's shelter in Iceland. You know, some crimes seem truly unforgivable. What then?
There are many people who will not forgive certain things, and we have to respect that. The murder of a child. Many people will not go there. But I have a friend who lost her daughter to abduction and murder. And she ended up first wanting to strangle the guy with her bare hands. She eventually realized her hatred was destroying her family. Over time, she did forgive the man. And she advocated against the death penalty for him.
The four keys to finding forgiveness, even in impossible circumstances. Up next, I'm Anne Strangeamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRX. We all know we're supposed to forgive. It's just the right thing to do, morally, ethically, spiritually. But how does it feel? Most people say good.
How did it feel to forgive? Forgive him?
Yeah.
Forgive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a harder question than it should be. Wow.
How did it feel? Yeah, sometimes you just have to do it in order to move on.
It feels great.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the more you understand, forgiveness is for yourself, too.
I have forgiven her because I guess my love for my sister is more important than whether I was on the side of right or wrong. I guess it just felt psychologically freeing.
I feel like it's usually like a weight lifted off your shoulder.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry about it anymore.
Oh, yeah, that's a weight off, yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't. It probably meant nothing for her, but it... You know, it meant a lot.
Like relieving. Like mm-hmm. It feels relieving. Mm-hmm. Is that a word?
Relieving.
Yeah.
It actually feels really good. I mean, depending on the case, sometimes there's that aspect of, I told you so, because we're all humans.
But if you hold on to that and you can't forgive, then I think it only hurts you more.
Kind of
better to forgive.
It's like on a tangent.
Better to
right
forgive,
now.
Right?
Better to forgive than not to forget.
No.
Not to forget.
Yeah, well, how it felt or what it meant to you, but then to forgive.
Forgiving. Produced by our summer intern. Way to go, Karen McKechnie. When I married my husband, someone gave us a piece of advice. Never go to bed angry. We've tried not to. Occasionally, we've had to stay up until 1 in the morning to finish an argument. But most of the time, we've been able to say, I'm sorry, and really mean it before going to sleep. It can be a struggle, though. So here's something I wish I'd known years ago. It turns out, the secret to forgiveness can be summarized in 4 easy steps, according to psychologist Robert Enright. He's one of the leading authorities on the science of forgiveness. He's even been called the father of forgiveness research. And he walked Charles Monroe Kane through the steps towards lasting forgiveness.
You first of all have to struggle against a resentment that could be yours for the rest of your life. And you try, as best you can, to offer a goodness toward the other who was not good to you. That is very active. That might take the form of a returned email or phone call or a smile or a good word about them. All that's very, very active. I think when people think about forgiveness as lying down and accepting the injustices, it's a misunderstanding of what it is.
But you see why people see it that way, right?
Sure.
There's an injustice done to them, whatever it is. And then you're like, well, if I don't get back at that person or if there's not something done to that person, then I lose.
That's right. And there's another confusion, though, because forgiveness is a moral virtue. It goes back thousands of years to ancient Greece, but so does justice. And in fact, justice by Plato is considered to be the primary virtue. All the others revolve around it, including forgiveness. And we don't practice forgiveness in isolation. So when we forgive, we can get rid of our resentment, offer goodness to those who aren't being good to us, and then with greater clarity of mind, we can ask something of the other.
with greater energy.
But you're forgiving first.
But you're forgiving
first, right?
You're forgiving first. But then with that clarity of mind and greater energy, you can live to, shall we say, fight another day.
Okay, I want to break this down. I have a mental illness. I hear voices. I take medication for it now, but most of my life I didn't. When I was a teen, there was a certain religious leader in my life that I felt exploited me, used my mental illness as they thought as a gift, and I think used me. You know, I'm 48 years old, so that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
So I am hitting the first step. I recognize that I'm angry. That's your first step.
That's right. You recognize you've been treated unfairly.
Yes, and I think I've been treated very unfairly, and I can articulate and understand it. So next is what? I got to decide to forgive?
Well, the next is, do you want to live your life with this guy living inside you for the rest of your life? Mm-hmm. And part of non-forgiveness is you can ruminate on him, dream about him. You might pass by a house of worship, and you remember him. It triggers. And the question is, do you want to be freed from that? So you don't just forgive. You examine how that injustice is affecting your life.
Right, got it. That makes sense. Okay.
Okay. So that's the first step, right?
So let's, for theoretical reasons here, let's say I decide to forgive this guy. Okay.
Yeah.
Hypothetically, I could say I want that. But in the real world, I'm not sure I want to forgive him.
Right.
What do you do with that?
Well, what you do with that is ask, why do you not want to? Do you think you're giving him something that you want to kind of hold over his head?
Oh, sure,
right. Okay? So, you know, if I don't forgive him, that's giving me power. Well, it might be giving you power, but it also might be giving you weakness, where, again, you're ruminating on him and he's bringing you down. So the question is, if you don't want to forgive him for him, where you don't want to be good for his sake, the first question is, do you want to be good for your sake, you see?
So, okay, let's say I forgive this guy, and I feel released from that, and it's a powerful experience for me. Now, working on forgiveness is the next step.
Yep.
For me and my sister, what would that mean? So I would do what?
Okay, first of all, you would know you'd be giving him a goodness he doesn't necessarily deserve, that you are willing to try this. You won't necessarily reconcile with him. You can forgive him and never see him again, especially if he would harm you again. You see, that's the deal. So then if you wanted to go ahead, the first thing we would do is have you take, again, with this idea of a wide-angle lens, start looking at this person in new ways. Okay, here would be some questions I would have for you. Who is this person who really hurt you? Is he only an exploiter who used your challenge for his gain? Is that all he is? And I'd ask you to truly examine that. And then I'd ask you this. What do you think his inner world is like? Hmm. If he exploits you and 100 others, what do you think his inner world is like as he lives his life day to day across time? Do you think he's happy? Do you think there might be a gnawing discontent or even guilt? And I wonder what it's like for him to live with that guilt. And I'd like you to just think about that for a moment.
But you seem, you know, I hear you talking, but I'm like, I can imagine if something was done to me that was really deep, you know, you're raped, someone's killed in your family, you'd be like, what do I have to have empathy for this guy for?
You don't. The point is, you have to first get over the trauma. See, forgiveness is not a magic button we push. That's a misunderstanding. Forgiveness is a pathway. It's a journey, and it unfolds. Mm-hmm. You first have to allow yourself time to mourn, to be angry. There's nothing wrong with being angry.
Right.
I think it's a natural protective emotion. It's just when it gets out of control that we have a problem. So I think if you said, why the heck should I forgive this guy? I would be with you. Mm. I would say, right, why should you? You have to heal first. And then if that comes up, then we'll talk about it. But if we jump to forgiveness first, we're doing you a disservice.
Does it ever end? Does the journey ever end? Is there a moment where you say, I'm released from this?
Well, is there ever an end to a journey of being physically fit? If you think about it, you can become forgivingly fit. I think it's the same thing with forgiveness. Mm-hmm. We get to what we might call a tipping point, where we realize that the work we have done is paying dividends internally. Mm. I am quieter. I am less anxious. I am less angry, which may want me to continue going on. But we should never hold that out as now a pressure, a norm, that because person A did it, person B must. Because forgiveness is a choice. It's your freedom to accept this and go forward or not. It's up to you. So when people don't want to forgive, I say, let's not put pressure on them to do so.
Now, we're talking a lot of what we're talking about in the micro level between me and you, which makes sense. I talk about somebody we did an interview about this person. His name is General Butt Naked. You probably know who he is. He was the warlord leader of the Children Brigade in Liberia.
I do. I remember that.
And he changed. He converted to Christianity, and he went through Liberia and basically crawled across the country begging for forgiveness.
Mm.
How do you mend a place like Liberia with that much complicated pain?
I'm working in Liberia as you speak.
Well, there you go.
In Monrovia. And it's helping the children to learn to forgive, but gently and quietly. I just gave a Skype session to Monrovia recently, and then we had a question and answer through Skype, and the first child came up, looked into the little camera of the computer and said very innocently, "How can I forgive the person who killed my mother?" And I thought, oh, my goodness, I've got to teach a class today. I'm on the floor here, kid. Okay, and I did the best I could. And I said, you have to take your time. And then the next child came up and said, "I loved my sister so, and she was killed in the Civil War. Can I forgive the person?" And by that, I was flat out just, I was gone for the day. When you get to a situation like this, you do seem to have champions of forgiveness who are, let's like Martin Luther King Jr., okay? And it's usually a heroic act when there are grave, grave injustices. But we have to realize it's going to take a lot of time.
Right.
And we can't go in there with a few books and a few curriculum guides for forgiveness education and say, now that we're here, let's get on with it. We have to see the people as they are. They're gravely wounded on all levels.
Sure.
Okay? But unless they do something, I'm really concerned that the anger level and the despondency could go on for decades, if not centuries.
That's incredible. It's so incredible to think about in places like Liberia and even in Ireland where it's done on purpose. Well, rape will be done to impregnate women from a different tribe so that the child is hated, and they're trying to give you reasons not to forgive.
That's right.
I guess you got to move. If you can't move on, there needs to be justice. I understand that.
Right.
But if you can't interpersonally move on, you're just done.
That's the deal. See, what happens is then you suffer the injustice twice. You suffer all of this brutality, and it's starkly evil. Let's call it what it is.
Sure.
But now you also could be done in by the effects of that evil. In other words, how I am responding to it. And you can then infect your children and their children's children's children with a gnawing resentment that becomes normative in a society and becomes part of how they live.
Yeah.
And now they've suffered twice. And the enemy could be doing their work, even though the enemy is long dead, they could be doing their work 100 years from now in the hearts of those who don't know how to cast off the resentment.
Psychologist Robert Enright talking with Charles Monroe Kane. Growing up, writer Rod Dreher dreamed of escaping his small town in rural Louisiana. Once he was old enough, he hightailed it out of there, moved to the East Coast, became a film and culture critic, and wound up writing for places like the New York Post and the National Review. And then he had a crisis of faith. Priest abuse scandals in the Catholic Church shattered his sense of safety. He spoke to Steve Paulson about the psychic shock of losing his religion and the series of events that in the end sent him back home to St. Francisville, Louisiana, searching for forgiveness.
It was the most painful thing I've ever experienced, and I'm someone who in recent years buried his younger sister and his father, yet nothing was as painful as losing my Catholic faith. I had come into the Catholic Church in my mid-20s after a period of strong agnosticism. I had a pretty profound conversion. This was in the 1990s. Changed for me was being in New York City at the New York Post and beginning to write in the early 2000s about the Catholic sex abuse scandal. I was writing about it before things broke big out of Boston, but certainly the Boston catastrophe ramped things up greatly.
And where they basically tried to cover it up.
Exactly. And it's not so much for me the priest who actually committed the abuse as it was bishops and other clerics within the Catholic institution that turned a blind eye to it and ground families and victims under their boots. I ended up leaving the Catholic Church, became Eastern Orthodox, but for me, it was not a matter of I'm going to leave this wicked institution and go to a pure one. I don't think there is any pure one, and the Orthodox Church has problems too. But what the difference was, I had been really broken by my own intellectual pride, and I had thought that as long as I kept all the syllogisms clear in my mind about why the Catholic Church is the true faith, then my inner self was a fortress that could never be breached. I was wrong.
But there were a lot of Catholics who said that Christians have a duty to forgive and that being a good Catholic meant that you had to let go of the anger and move on as opposed to just renouncing the church. And I'm wondering why you didn't buy that argument.
Well, I bought it in my head. I knew that it is not the case that the sins of the bishops or the priests negate the truths that the church proclaims. But for me, my Catholicism was so much stuck in my head. And so when it came time to forgive, when I heard that you must forgive, I interpreted that as the bishops and those who apologized for them using the very precious Christian teaching of forgiveness as a way to avert justice. You know, I think you have to forgive to get rid of the anger and to make the way clear for healing. But I saw very little repentance or any real intention of doing justice in the Catholic Church on the part of the Catholic institution. So for me, this call to forgiveness was what Dietrich Bonhoeffer called cheap grace.
Hmm. Do you think there are certain acts that are just simply beyond forgiveness? They should not be forgiven?
No, I can't say that as a Christian. I don't believe that because if I said that, I would be condemning myself. But I do believe that forgiveness, for it to be an effective thing, it has to have repentance involved as well. And we have to seek justice as much as we possibly can, realizing that there's no such thing as perfect justice in this world. And, you know, in my own personal case, I had to come to reckon with that in my own family. And I had to learn how to forgive my own father, even though I saw in him no repentance for the wrongs he had done. Yet I had to love him anyway.
And why did you have to forgive your father? What was going on there?
Well, back in the end of 2011, after my younger sister Ruthie died, my wife and I felt that we needed to move from Philadelphia back to my hometown in Louisiana, a little town called St. Francisville, to care for my parents and to help care for my sister's children. And I took it as sort of a return of the prodigal son. I had moved away from this town.
Become this big success, and you know, yeah. the local boy has done good.
Right. But as far as my father was concerned, he was the quintessential old Southern country gentleman. He thought that he was the center of the world and life in our small town was the center of the world. And I had been disloyal by leaving it. I was his only son. And you know, for a Southern man of his generation, that counted for something. So I came back and I thought he would receive me, but as it turned out, he didn't receive me because he resented that I wasn't like him.
So you went back wanting to mend fences and it actually made it worse then.
Yeah. Oh, no, it did. And this rejection just tore me to bits. I got physically ill. I fell into a deep depression. And around that time, too, I stumbled into the Divine Comedy of Dante Alighieri, and that helped me. But
reading Dante helped you deal with your father?
Yeah. I mean, strangely enough, I tell you, it was unmasking things within me, flaws within myself, brokenness within myself that I had not dealt with.
Give me an example. I mean, what did you get from reading Dante's Divine Comedy that actually sort of applied to your own life?
Oh, what didn't I get? There's a part in the Inferno when Dante, the pilgrim Dante, is walking with Virgil through a cemetery in hell. And, well, he passes by an open tomb, flames coming out of the tomb, and out of this open grave and amid the fire rises this incredibly arrogant Florentine aristocrat named Farinata. So he says, "I hear the voice of a Tuscan passing. Come closer. Let me see if you're worth talking to." I said, "Oh, this is going to be great." So in the poem, the pilgrim Dante and Farinata start arguing back and forth about Florence and politics in Florence, and they start trash-talking each other. And I'm reading this thinking, Dante, walk away from this guy. He's dead. He's in hell. He thinks he's still back in Florence where he matters. Then it occurred to me, this is me and my dad. My father is still stuck on the glories of our family and the glories of our place here in the deep South. He doesn't see what's happening around him, but that's where he is. I can't move him, but I am like Dante the Pilgrim. I can walk away and refuse to be bound by this conversation.
So to bring this back to our earlier discussion about forgiveness, it sounds like you had to figure out how to forgive your father, and maybe he had to figure out how to forgive you. I don't know if he felt like he had to go there or not.
No, he didn't. And that's the thing that one of the things that drove me crazy. And I was still so filled with anger after I had that moment, that epiphany, and went to confession. I still had a lot of anger because I was dealing with him on an almost daily basis. And just the hard-headedness of my dad, who was really, I mean, he was a confessing Christian, but he was far more stoic than Christian. And he just had to be right about everything. And
he didn't feel any need to have to ask for forgiveness.
No.
He was on the right side of everything.
Of course he was. He was Farinata. He was a Farinata of the Bayou. And I would go to my priest and I would confess anger over and over. And he said, "What do you want?" I said, "Well, I want justice." He said, "What does love know of justice?" And he explained to me, he said, "Look, you may never get justice from your father. Your father may never love you like you think he ought to love you, but that doesn't release you from the obligation to love him." My priest said, "I'm not telling you to overlook what he's done, because he has done you wrong, but you still have to find a way to love him."
And did you? Did you get rid of the anger towards your father?
Well, yes and no. I mean, things did get better. As it happened, on the day before Good Friday, 2015, my dad asked me to take him to the next town over to get a haircut. We were driving home, and he said, "You know, I think that I'm nearing the end of my life." And I said, "Well, Daddy, is there anything you want me to do for you? Can I call somebody, an old friend? Is there someone you need to forgive, or is there someone you need to ask forgiveness of?" He said, "Well, I've never done anything wrong in my life." I looked at him like, "You're 81 years old and you can say that?" Because he was a smart, smart man, but a prideful one. And so we started arguing again. And when I dropped him off at his house, I thought, you know, that was stupid of me. I'm expecting too much of him. I should have never have brought it up. Well, the next morning I went over there, Steve. This is Good Friday morning. He was on home hospice care at that point, and he had too many medications to handle himself, so I did it for them. I found him on his front porch, sitting in his rocking chair, drinking his coffee, reading his morning paper there in the country, and I kissed him on the cheek, wished him good morning, ran in, did his pills for him, came out and said, "I'm in a hurry. I've got a lot of work to do today." He grabbed my arm, Steve, and I looked down at him, and that old man, there were tears in his eyes. And my dad is not one who cried, but there were tears in his eyes, and his chin was quivering, and he said to me, "I spent a long time talking to the Lord last night about my transgressions against you. And I told him how sorry I was. I think he heard me." It took so much for him to do that, make that simple apology. And I kissed my dad, accepted what he said, and then went about my business. But I thought the rest of the day, if I had not come home and walked through this own personal inferno and purgatorio of my family, I would never have been there to hear my dad say those words. And I was so grateful, because when my dad died later that summer, I was able to spend the last 8 days of his life caring for him, praying with him and for him, giving him his medication, and just being there with him so that when he breathed his last, I was holding his hand. And the only way that I had found that sort of peace that passes all understanding in his death was by forgiveness.
Journalist Rod Dreher. His latest book is The Benedict Option. He talked to Steve Paulson.
I grew up in a very white East London suburb this was a big kind of far right area, really. I mean, there were people distributing literature for the National Front. And it was quite a scary place to be a young brown boy. But at the same time, some of the most racist people in the neighborhood were listening to all the soul and funk music. And so, I mean, when I was very young, I was buying Grandmaster Flash and the SOS Band and Houdini and all this music that kind of came from a very different place from mine. It was not my story, but it meant quite a lot to me as a kid trying to work out about oppression and also trying to find a stance which would be mine.
Novelist Harry Kunzru talks about the blues, cultural crime, and white guilt after a quick break. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio. NPRX. Draw the line between cultural appreciation and appropriation or theft? I mean, for example, take popular music.
Everybody knows suburban white hip-hop boys who desperately, desperately want to be from the street and to have the credibility and the intensity of experience that they imagine belongs to the rappers that they're listening to. But I suppose the simplest way I can put it is that there's a difference between loving something and trying to own it.
Harry Kunzru takes on the complicated racial history of American music in his new novel, White Tears. It's a story of two white college friends, Seth and Carter. Seth's an audio geek. Carter's rich and an obsessive collector of early blues music. And one day, while he's wandering around New York City, Seth accidentally records a street musician singing what sounds to him like an old blues tune. The boys start mucking around with this recording with disastrous consequences.
These guys, they put the guitar line and the vocal together, and they throw a lot of hiss and crackle over the top of it and make it sound as if it's an authentic 1920s blues recording, and they put it out onto the internet, and they fool a lot of people. There are people imagining that they found a real old record, and they're very smug. And then an old collector gets in touch with them and says, "When did you get this record? I last heard this record in 1959. And they say, no, we made it up. And he says, "Oh, no, you didn't." And at that point, the possibility emerges that they haven't made something. They've merely channeled something that wanted to be heard again. And I make it a ghost story about sound.
The song that the boys record, you wrote the lyrics for it. It's in the book. Can you hear it in your head? Is there an actual song you hear?
There's not a particular tune, but I mean, the secret of that song is that I didn't write it. Every couplet is a traditional couplet. Those things are all from blues and work songs. You know, that's the tradition talking. You know, I put me under a man called Captain Jack. He wrote his name all down my back. That's the kind of violence that was done to people. And believe I buy me a graveyard of my own, put my enemies all down in the ground. That desire for revenge against your enemies and perhaps a magical revenge is also there in the blues tradition. There are many of these couplets, and they kind of float around and become, you know, they speak in a way that's more than individual, more than personal. And so I feel like, you know, from that point of view, I was just channeling something.
Mm. The ghost that stalks these boys is the ghost of this nameless musician. They call him Charlie Shaw. It's not at this point clear whether they invented Charlie Shaw or whether Charlie Shaw actually existed or possibly even still exists. He's sort of amorphous, and he seems to be stalking or hunting them. Tell me more about this ghost.
Well, ghost stories are always about repression, aren't they? I mean, a ghost story is always about something in the past that happened and was prematurely suppressed or forgotten, and that is trying to kind of punch its way out of the past into the present and kind of grab hold of people in the present. That's what's terrifying, being dragged back into the troubles of the past, into the horror of the past. And this figure from the 20s, a musician who was never recorded or perhaps was recorded, but somebody whose existence is in doubt, is kind of reaching forward into the present day and grabbing these two retro-loving white hipsters and forcing them into a kind of confrontation with the tradition that they rather can casually dabble in.
But there's a mythic element too. I mean, you clearly at a few points are alluding to the old legend about Robert Johnson, the idea that he sold his soul to the devil in exchange for musical talent.
Yeah, that's become the primal story of the blues. He went down to the crossroads and he got down on his knees and he sold his soul to the devil to learn to play guitar. And the idea of a kind of diabolical talent, or an idea that the blues has something of the dark side about it. But a lot of musicians, I think Johnson included, would spruce themselves up and play at the Sunday picnic and play some gospel songs. And then on a, you know, Saturday night would be in a juke singing completely different kind of music. Which amuses me and I think shows a kind of pitfall for folk collecting and a kind of fetishization of authenticity, as if there are these musicians who've sort of risen up out of the river mud of the Delta, whereas actually some of them are much more sophisticated and worldly and modern than people give them credit for.
And that folk story, you know, that black Faustian figure who sells his soul to the devil for, you know, brilliance on the guitar or the fiddle, that story exists in more than one culture. I mean, it's not
absolutely
unique,
yes,
to hear. So then, which then makes it complicated because, you know, then you think, wow, this is possibly just a giant projection onto this music. And then whose soul is being stolen?
Right. I mean, having said that, there's a great deal of black magic around the edges of the blues. I mean, you think of the idea of the jinx. Mm. You know, I mean, there are some wonderful lyrics where, you know, the jinx is almost like a physical creature, like a cat or a wolf or something that's actually kind of prowling around your bed and, you know, bringing you bad luck is a kind of almost physical thing. And I mean, back to Robert Johnson, he has a famous song called Stones in My Passway, and that seems to be a fairly straightforward reference to West African footfall magic, where if you want to do harm to somebody else, you'll put a magical object where they'll have to tread on it or walk over it, and it will bring them harm or bring them luck. So somebody, you know, Johnson feels that somebody has cursed him.
At this point in the narrative, Seth sets out for the back roads of Mississippi trying to track down this mysterious, is it a musician, is it a ghost, and figure out what's happening. And he has this strong sense that this is somehow something he's done before, something that's kind of like replaying a record. It seems to me there's something you're saying here about history and repetition.
Doom, isn't it? You know, this is a very future-oriented culture. I think, you know, I grew up in Britain and it's noticeable to me in America that it's all, you know, orientated towards the future. And the flip side of that is that people are kind of uncomfortable with the past in some ways, partly because, you know, bad things were done to get us here. And I like the idea of watching a character who is haunted by the past.
I was also wondering whether in some ways you're also talking about or kind of channeling what it's felt like to be in America the last few years with, you know, the kind of racial violence and police shooting and, you know, people dying in police custody and the Black Lives Matter protests. There is, you know, kind of underneath the feeling of a certain inevitability to all of this, as though you know, the seeds of this were planted so long ago and repressed, and it was only a matter of time.
If this novel has an origin moment for me, it's the moment quite soon after I arrived to live here when Barack Obama got elected. And suddenly all the media was full of, by and large, white people saying, well, welcome to a post-racial America. You know, we've done this now. A black man has become president. That means surely that this terrible history is over and we no longer need to look at it anymore. And it seemed that that was done with such indecent haste. And it was a tell to me. It was a tell that there's a lot of anxiety and a lot of guilt that people wish to close down and didn't wish to face. And then, you know, and of course, instead of post-racial America, what have we got? You know, in the last few years, racial anxiety has bubbled up in this country. And so, I mean, I think of it, although it's a novel about the past and about history, it is trying to use that history to speak to our current predicament.
There's a scene near the end of the book that's a really powerful scene. Seth winds up in a graveyard at night on his knees. He's trying to beg for mercy, and he's not even sure who he's trying to beg for mercy from. I guess the question I have is, you know, we've been talking about the ghosts of unresolved, unfinished business of the past and about retribution and violence that repeats in cycles. Is it ever possible to lay that kind of ghost?
I think the only way to do that is to honestly face that history and also to know that in a certain, very particular way, it's not really about your personal guilt or innocence. You know, it's not about you. And rather than thinking of your personal absolution or, you know, your personal sort of escape from the past, I mean, I think it's much more important to look at the structures, the material conditions. You know, I'm very struck by what continuity there is between the kind of practices that were used to control black people in the period of the Reconstruction, you know, after slavery, and the kind of penal practices and the policing practices now. I mean, you look at what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, which became the sort of flashpoint for this new civil rights movement. And that had a great deal to do with a kind of policing that would have been completely familiar to the people in Mississippi in 1925. Mm-hmm. And all this survives in structures. It survives in flows of money and power. And that's the way to solve this, is to address these questions rather than, you know, trying to wriggle out of your personal feelings of guilt.
Harry Kunzru. His new novel is called White Tears.
Early this morning, when you knocked upon my door.
That's it for this hour, but you can always catch more in our podcast feed. If you like the show, do us a favor. Leave us a review on iTunes or whatever podcasting app you're using. That really helps other people find us. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tankekar produced this hour with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Mark Rickers, Doug Gordon, and Karen McKechnie. Joe Hartke is our technical wizard. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strangehamps. Thanks for listening.